Today's Tesho will be on case 78 in the Book of Serenity. Case 78 is entitled Yunmen's Sesame Cake. Introduction. Seeing the price throughout the heavens, paying it all over the earth, 100 plans, traveling in search, is all an embarrassment. Is there anyone who knows when to advance and when to retreat? What is admissible and what is blameworthy? A monk asked Yunmen, what is talk transcending the Buddhas and ancestors? Yunmen said, sesame cake. Verse, sesame cake, he says, in a talk transcending Buddhas and ancestors. In the phrase, there is no flavor, how can it be investigated? If patchrobe mendicants one day know repletion, then they will see Yunmen's face is not ashamed. Thank you so much for coming here to practice Zen this morning. You know, these Saturday sits are a wonderful opportunity to deepen your practice. You know, it's absolutely essential if you want to walk the path of Zen to make a regular place for this in your life. You know, we're all very busy, but it's still possible to, you know, set aside, say, half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour, and sometimes even more than an hour every day. You know, it's difficult to do that at first, so it's a good idea to sort of build up gradually. Maybe do a sit of half an hour every third day, or something like that, and then make it every second day. And, you know, if you were to sit, say, five times a week on your own, you would find it hugely helpful in your life. It would be, your attitude would be transformed fairly soon. You know, so making a place for this in your life is really important. We have all kinds of things tugging at us and pulling at us. But, you know, actually, some of the things that are tugging at us and pulling at us don't have to be attended, at least for half an hour. So, you know, there is a kind of culture of busyness. It's people feel a little bit guilty if they aren't actually busy all the time. They feel like they're not doing their job. And people will get together. I will have lunch with somebody and they'll say, oh, I'm so busy. And the other person will say, oh, me too, I'm so busy, you know. And well, I'm busier than you are. Oh no, you know, I'm busy. It's competitive busyness. And busyness is a sign of many things. It's a symbol of many things. But one of the things it's a symbol of is that we are we're doing our job. Another thing it's a symbol of is that we're useful and needed. And that can even be like a substitute for being loved, right? So if you have lots of emails, it's almost like you have lots of people who want to say hello to you. And that's a wonderful feeling, right? A lot of them are spam, however, right? So, you know, when you say, oh my God, I get hundreds of emails a day, that's like, say, it's like Twitter followers. I have, you know, 50,000 Twitter followers. You know, I get hundreds of emails, or me too. You know, I get even more than hundreds, you know. So, you know, when my friends are sitting around talking about how crazy busy they are, you know, I'm pretty busy too. But, you know, it's possible to make half an hour, carve out half an hour in a day you know, even if it's on your lunch break, and meditate. And doing this is so important. You know, first of all, you know, a lot of the busyness we're engaged with is not real busyness. You know, it's spinning your wheels. It's just, you know, I often have noticed that I will be waiting for like a bus or something. And I'll notice that especially young people are all texting, you know, or they're waiting for the bus and they're texting. You know, in the old days, before we had phones, while you were waiting for the bus, you looked around. You know, you looked around and you noticed maybe an old person sitting on a bench reading a book. You noticed some kids shooting baskets in the basketball court. You know, you might have noticed a bird, you know, on the top of a trash can. And this is actually has a profound profound effect on people, right? You know, allowing your consciousness to drift in an unstructured way is actually very liberating. So, you know, in the old days, before we had phones, you were waiting for the bus, and, you know, basically, you said, you let yourself off the hook. You said, well, what can be done? You know, I've got to wait for the bus. So then you let yourself fall into unstructured time. And time, when it's unstructured, takes on a different form. It's no longer pressurized, right? It's no longer busy, busy, busy. It suddenly becomes rather aimless and open. And this is actually, I think, a delicious experience. Really a delicious experience. Just allowing events to unfold as they're going to unfold and allowing your consciousness to drift along with the flow of events. This is actually a deeper state of consciousness than busy, busy texting all the time. And a lot of the busy, busy texting and tweeting and so on is anxiety response to the openness of the moment. Yes, all of that texting, all of that turning to your phone is an anxiety. You know, the moment you have a delay in your bus schedule and you're sitting there with nothing to do, anything that's bothering you is going to come to the surface. So if you're worried about something, you know, there it is. It's right there. And so I think what people, or if you're anxious, you know, when is the bus going to come? If the bus doesn't come, I'm going to be late. So turning to your iPhone and starting to text is a way of getting control over the situation, right? It's a way of reaffirming your control over your time by putting the structure back into everything. You're insisting on the regular routine, you know? But this actually is not good for your mind. You know, what's better for your mind is unstructured time under situations you can't control. And when you do that, time takes on when you allow that to happen, time takes on a totally different quality or texture. The sense of pressurized minute-by-minute sequence goes away, and you're suddenly in a kind of open flow. It might not even feel like a flow. It's almost like it's just like there, right? It's like this spaciousness. And just being with that spaciousness is so refreshing and so liberating if you can overcome your anxiety. Because entering that spaciousness is a little bit scary for people who don't permit themselves to enter that spaciousness. The unstructured time makes people feel guilty sometimes. And they feel guilty, really, because the unstructuredness of it seems uncontrollable. Uncontrollable. And we think we should be able to control everything. You know, when I was younger, it was a very different United States in the 1970s. And many young people in those days used to hitchhike, and I was one of those young people. And I hitchhiked from basically Washington, D.C., all the way to California, and then up to Seattle in, you know, about a week. And then I've done it many times when I was young. I would hitchhike across the country. You go out on a highway. It can't be an interstate, or you'll be arrested for hitchhiking on the interstate. But you can stand at the entryway to the interstate, and there's usually a sign, or there used to be a sign that says, "No hitchhikers beyond this point." So you could stand right in front of the sign, and you could stick your thumb out, or sometimes you would have a sign that would say, "San Francisco," or something like that. And somebody who was driving to San Francisco in those days would actually pick you up and give you a ride, just because they wanted some companionship in the car. Lots of students used to commute from home to their universities by hitchhiking. And I did a great deal of hitchhiking, and I found it really good. I didn't realize, but it was really good preparation for my later Zazen practice. Because when you stand out on a road waiting for a ride, you can't control the situation. You know, you wait in front of the sign that says "No hitchhikers beyond this point," and you stick out your hand and you smile, and you look non-threatening, and you're hoping somebody will pick you up. And you don't know who is going to drive by. Some people may be driving by and they're only going to a couple miles and turning off the highway. Some people might be going 500 miles. Right, so there's a lot of chance. Somebody might look at you and just say, that person doesn't look trustworthy, and drive on. And somebody might look at you and think, oh, what a nice young man, I'll give this young man a ride. But that person might only be going one stop. You know, the person going to San Francisco might not like your face. So it's highly uncontrollable, and all you can do is get out on the road as soon as you can. So when I would hitchhike, I would get up. Sometimes I would sleep, believe it or not, near a rest stop or wherever I would sleep. And I would get out on the road and I would hitchhike, hold out my thumb, and somebody would pick me up and right away sometimes. And sometimes I'd be waiting half a day. And sometimes a person would take me 500 miles and sometimes they'd take me 50 miles. All uncontrollable. You can't make anything happen. And when you enter this kind of time, it's very different from the kind of time we normally live. It's like you can't control anything, and at first you're impatient. It's like, come on, where's the ride? Where's my ride? And if you have a watch, you look at your watch, you got out on the highway at 8 o'clock, it's now 9:30 and nobody's driving by. And you think, oh my God, the whole day's going to go by, I'm going to be standing on this highway, which could happen, which has happened to me. You know, so you have this experience of like frustration. Your part of you is still trying to push forward into the future. You know, get this done. But when you realize you can't get it done, it's beyond your control, you know, you might go through a period where you're feeling a little frustrated or even angry. But eventually you just give up. You just say, I can't control this. I'm just going to be present here. And you begin to notice things, right? You suddenly look to your left and you see there's a corral with a horse in it. And there's an Indian boy riding the horse. You know, this happens. And you never would have noticed because you were so obsessed with getting from point A to point B. You know, you see the clouds coming over and you realize, oh my gosh, those are such beautiful clouds. And that sense of pressurized time goes away, and there's this wonderful openness, right? Openness. It's like, what is coming next? What is coming next? This is a different experience of time. And on the cushion, something very similar happens. You know, if you can just put your phone down, And if you can make a little time every day just to sit down, it's like getting into that zone, that open space, a little bit every day. And it makes a huge difference in your life. Because, you know, we live in this society that is obsessed with the illusion of busyness. And a lot of it's counterproductive or unproductive. You know, there's a wonderful essay by a writer named, I think it's Blake Gopnik is his name. And he lives in New York, and like all New Yorkers, he's very busy all the time. And it turns out that his daughter actually has an imaginary friend. The daughter's imaginary friend, when he began to talk to his daughter about the imaginary friend, the daughter explained that, yes, when she's able to be with her imaginary friend, they have a lot of fun together, but sometimes he's too busy to play with her. And that's her imaginary friend. So this culture of busyness is really not real. A lot of the time we're just spinning our wheels. And we're putting pressure on ourselves because we're a little afraid of not controlling what's going to happen, not controlling our lives. And we're a little afraid of that open space, When you're waiting for the bus and you're getting nervous because the bus isn't coming and you start texting, you're trying to get back into that highly structured way of life. And the uncontrollable is overtaking you. And it's frightening you, right? So it's like back to the phone. But if you put the phone away, please be present with the uncontrollable. It's the Tao. It's the Tao, like Lao Tzu, right? It's making yourself available to the energy of the universe on its own terms, not on your terms, right? Human beings have created an artificial world, that's highly compressed, highly structured, very demanding. And it's not surprising so many people are unhappy or not in good health or depressed because it's such a compressed, structured, and closed world. But if you make a half an hour a day for zazen, for chan, you know, suddenly you will have these moments where you experience that spaciousness. It's your true nature calling you. To be in that spaciousness is absolutely liberating. And of course, when you sit down on the cushion, you won't at first feel that spaciousness. You'll feel guilt for not doing something, quote, useful, right? So I should be doing something else, right? You'll have that feeling. Right now I could be grading papers. Right now I could be writing my report. I hope you see that that's a terrible way to live. You know, sometimes we have to write the report. We do have to sit down and write the report, but we don't have to write the report every hour of the day. So it's hugely liberating to realize, you know, this is a kind of game that people play with each other, but I'm not going to play that game right now. I'm going to sit down and allow myself to experience unstructured time. Unstructured time is difficult to get into. You know, I used to go to the Seattle Zen Center every morning. I get there for a sitting at 5:30 was when the Zazen started. So my friend John Sunston, who was a professor in the medical school, would pick me up and some other people and take us to our temple to sit with our Roshi, our Shifu, in the morning at 5:30. And every morning when I would sit down on the cushion, the first thing I would think about is all the things I haven't done and needed to do. And I would say to myself, what am I doing here? This is crazy. I should be, you know, back in my apartment working on my dissertation or something like that. You know, if I were back in my apartment working on my dissertation, the chances are I wouldn't be doing it. I'd be procrastinating. I'd be listening to the radio. I'd have another cup of coffee. I would waste time in 1,000 different ways, right? But, you know, as I'm going into meditation, the first thought is I should be doing something else. What I'm really reacting to is that openness. You know, doing zazen is like hitchhiking. You can't control it. You know, you sit down on the cushion and you just have to be available to whatever happens. You know, if you stick out your thumb on the highway, sometimes a car comes by and it says, oh, I'm going all the way to San Francisco. And you jump in the car and you ride all the way to San Francisco. And sometimes the person driving the car will buy you lunch even. You know, they're just so happy to have a companion in the car. Well, sometimes you sit down on the cushion and you enter deep samadhi right away. And you feel like, oh, this is so wonderful. This is the ride from Chicago to San Francisco. But sometimes you sit down on the cushion and nothing happens. It's like sitting at the entrance to the interstate and nobody's driving by and nobody's picking you up. You know, you just have to let it go. Sometimes lightning is going to strike, but sometimes it's necessary for you to wait patiently. And when you wait patiently, at first it's very frustrating, especially for modern people who put such a premium on being in control of their situation. But if you stay with that openness for a while, you begin to relax and you begin to connect with everything around you. The pace of your awareness changes, the pacing, the pressure drops away, and there's this wonderful spaciousness. So it's really important to make time for that in your life and not be trapped by the illusion that you have no time. That everybody has, you could say, well, it's true. There's some things people have to deal with that I don't have to deal with. But nevertheless, you know, I'm pretty busy also. But it's imperative, really, that you remind yourself once a day or at least a couple times a week that there's this spaciousness you can go to. And when you go there, after it's over, you're going to feel better. You know, I just got a letter from somebody who's back in Germany, but she's been sitting with us for about 6 months. And she said, you know, I've been having a lot of problems. She was here doing research in the United States. And the research was very frustrating to her. And 20 years ago, she had done Zazen. And she wrote me this letter and she said, you know, the more problems I was having with my research, the more energy I was putting into it, and the more frustrated and unhappy I felt. You know, so when things weren't going well, she worked even harder. But actually, that didn't make things go any better. She was just working harder and not getting any better results. So I think she began to get a little depressed, and she came and started sitting here. And the first thing she says was, I don't really have time for this. But she sat with us 3 times a week and on Saturdays for 6 months. And she wrote me this glowing letter just saying how wonderful that felt and how liberating the experience was. And she was even saying, you know, I'm not going to go on with my research project. I'm going to find a new research project. And really, I think what she meant was, you know, she realized she didn't have to stay with this project. You know, when you sit in that openness for a while, you realize there are many more possibilities to life than you imagined. Making time for regular zazen, even if you're busy, or especially if you're busy, is very important. But it's even more important to practice here on a Saturday if you can make it, because what we're doing on Saturday is more zazen. You know, so if you sit for half an hour in your house, that's excellent, and please try to do that once a day or every other day. And if you have time, please try to do like 45 minutes or even an hour a couple times a week. And it will really change things. Eventually, you'll miss it. If you don't do it, you'll feel something's missing from your life if you just do this regularly for a little while. But the Saturday sits are really special because we do multiple sits in a row, right? We do three periods in the morning, and that's a long stretch. And then there's a bathroom break, and then we do two more periods. And then we have this teisho, which is a lot like meditation. You're supposed to be meditating while you listen. So, you know, that's an unparalleled opportunity to deepen your concentration. And the experience of a longer extended sitting is different from the experience of, say, half an hour every day. Something generally happens to you in the course of longer sitting periods. You know, one of the things that happens to you is that your body gets a little tired, you know? So, you know, if you do half an hour of zazen, your legs may not bother you. But if you do an hour of zazen towards the second part of that sitting period, your legs are going to bother you a little bit. And if we have three periods in a row, the way we do on Wednesday night or here, by the end of that three periods, your legs might be very tired. They might hurt you quite a bit. Now, you know, this experience is really important. You know, if you just sit for half an hour and you're pretty much comfortable in your sitting, you limit what you can experience in your meditation practice. You know, when you begin to do more zazen and you experience discomfort, there's a shift in your concentration, in your consciousness, that's very important. And you can't really reproduce that if you only sit for half an hour. And if you sit for 15 minutes, you'll never even get close. Meditation is not about having pain in your legs, but if you meditate for more than an hour, you will have pain in your legs. And if you have pain in your legs, it's actually very liberating. You know, even though nobody likes to have some discomfort or some pain in their legs, when you have pain in your legs, it forces you to go more deeply into your concentration. It forces you to go more deeply into concentration. So, if I'm sitting and I begin to have pain in my left leg, if I visualize my left leg, that makes it worse. Actually, after an hour of sitting, if you move, it will help a little bit, but in very little time, you'll be back in some discomfort again. So even moving doesn't help, actually. What has to happen is that when you're sitting for a longer period of time, you have to go into your breath more deeply. And you focus on the breath more tightly or intently. So, you know, after 25 minutes of sitting, no problem. After 45 minutes of sitting, you begin to have some pain in your leg. A natural inclination is to move your leg. And if you're in a lot of pain, feel free to move your leg. But if you're in a little bit of discomfort or a little bit of pain and you don't move your leg, this is the ideal situation. Ideal. Now, there are certain kind of people who have no patience for this argument. This would seem crazy to them. But when you're in that place of discomfort on the cushion and you don't move and you focus on your breath, it pushes you into deeper and deeper concentration. Deeper and deeper concentration. And you eventually notice that the relationship to your own body is changing. So at first, when you have pain in your leg, your inclination is to move, and if you don't move, you have to focus on the breath. Instead of thinking about the pain, think about the breath. Keep the back straight and focus on the breath. Follow the breath out, follow the breath out. And with your breath, you can sweep the pain sensation away. Now, if you keep doing this, you'll notice a change in the character of your awareness. After 15 minutes of this, you'll notice that your mind has become very, very still and empty. And in Zen, we call this state samadhi, samadhi. This is where your thinking begins to stop. And it might even feel physically like your head is full of cotton or it's stuffed with wood. This happens to people, right? Thinking begins to slow down, thoughts begin to disappear, your head begins to feel empty, sometimes like full of wood or full of cotton. You may feel like parts of your body are no longer present when you're in deep concentration, deep samadhi. All you feel sometimes are just your hands and your face. Much of your body seems to disappear. And this is like a very advanced state of concentration, samadhi. And when you enter this state of samadhi, you're now much more receptive, much more open to the world around you. And if I ring the bell and you get off the cushion and you go outside, you'll notice that everything is so vivid. Everything is so clean and clear. And this is because, ordinarily our experience of reality is filtered by all of these thoughts and all of this cultural conditioning. If you come in here on a Wednesday night and you do three periods of meditation and you walk outside, you might be blown away by how beautiful it all is. A few nights ago when we came out of the Zendo on Wednesday night, there was a moon in the sky, the temperature was perfect, the wind was blowing through the trees. After an hour and a half of being in samadhi, this is like this experience of the world as part of ourself is very powerful. It's like normal consciousness has all of these layers of screening between ourselves and the world, all of these like curtains, right, between ourselves and the world. We're looking through curtains at the world. And when you enter deep samadhi by sitting for long periods of time, you're beginning to pull those curtains away. And when you go outside, everything has this great immediacy or liveliness, aliveness. And this is like an enlightened state, actually. This is an altered state. From the Buddhist standpoint, this is closer to reality than we ordinarily allow ourselves to experience. Everything feels alive. Everything feels almost inseparable from ourselves. This experience is so beautiful that when you have it, you will probably never forget it. It's very difficult to explain this experience to anybody who hasn't had it. And they might not even believe you if you try to describe it. But if you do Zazen regularly, you will begin to have deeper and deeper experiences of samadhi on the cushion. And when you're off the cushion, you will have deeper and deeper experiences of connecting with the world around you. And you know, if your mind is distracted, if you're pressuring yourself to get from point A to point B, you know, you might have, if you were coming out of your office on Wednesday night instead of coming out of this room, you might not even have noticed the moon, or you might not even have noticed the wind blowing in the trees because you were thinking about your report, you were anxious about your boss, you were thinking about the electricity bill that has to be paid, and the world around you is invisible, right? There's like this many curtains keeping you from noticing the world around you. But when you take the time to go through this process of entering deep samadhi, it's like the whole world is purified. The whole world is purified. So, you know, in this koan, a monk says to Yunmen, "What is talk transcending the Buddhas and the ancestors?" In other words, he's saying, what is the highest teaching of enlightenment? What's the highest teaching of enlightenment? And he might be expecting Master Cloudgate to say something about reincarnation. Buddha realms, or other magical events, right? You know, when my teacher, Genki Roshi, when I was attendant to my teacher, my Shifu, he was visited by a very famous Zen teacher who was his Dharma brother, another monk from Japan. And my job was to get their meal ready for dinner for them at our Zen center in South Seattle. And I got the meal together, and some other members of our group prepared the meal. It was a delicious, really wonderful Japanese meal. And we were waiting in the kitchen, making sure all of this went well. Genki's meeting with this distinguished Roshi, this distinguished Shifu from Japan. And then when it was all over, the guest went to the guest quarters, and Genki came in the kitchen with us, and we cleaned up. He helped us clean up. We did the dishes. We had a dishwasher. We put dishes in the dishwasher. We put the food that wasn't used, we put it in balls and wrapped it in saran wrap and put it in the refrigerator. And then we, you know, most people went away, I was pretty much alone with Genki in the kitchen, and we had both had a cup. I made a cup of some tea, and we had a cup of tea, and I said, "Well, you know, Genki-san, what did you talk about with, I can't even remember this Roshi's name, with this other teacher. Did you talk about rebirth, your previous incarnations? I was just a beginner." And he laughed. He said, "No Zen teacher would talk about that." He says, "Who cares?" Right? And that really surprised me. Who cares what previous births you might have had? That doesn't matter. That's not liberation. Actually, recalling your past lives is not liberation. It's a valueless achievement. Real liberation is becoming one with the world around you. So even if you could sit down on the cushion and you could remember all the past lives you've ever had, that wouldn't make you a Buddha. How to become a Buddha is to sit on the cushion until your legs hurt and enter deep samadhi. And then, you know, the bell rings, you uncross your legs, and you go outside, and you become one with the world around you. That is Buddha mind. That is becoming a Buddha, yes. You know, samsara is separateness from everything. The state of samsara in Buddhism means to be separate from everything around you. And when you feel separate, you feel fearful, anxious, angry, envious. See, greed, anger, and delusion are produced by separateness. When you are, when you pass through deep samadhi and the self disappears, you begin to feel one with everything. Nirvana is one with everything. One with everything. And when you feel one with everything, no fear, no anger, no envy, and so on. See, the poisons are gone. There's nothing to be achieved and nowhere to go. Every place becomes your home. If you learn the art of leaving the small self and entering deep samadhi, this is the heart of the Buddha's teaching. So when this young monk asks Yunmen, Master Cloudgate, what is the highest teaching of the Buddhas? Yunmen says, a sesame cake. It's like a little cake you eat with tea. And if you have never done Zazen, you have no idea what that is, what Yunmen is talking about. But see, we people who practice Zen know. We know. You know, if you come in on a Wednesday night, you come into this room on a Wednesday night and you do one sit, the bell rings. Two sits, the bell rings. Three sits, now your legs are hurting a little bit. You really have to focus on the breath. You sweep the discomfort away and you drop down into deep samadhi. The bell rings. Now we serve dates and tea. And you put the date in your mouth, and it is heaven. It's heaven. Right? That date is the... People say to me, where did you get that tea? Where, that is the best tea I've had in my life. And indeed, it's very good tea. Yen often brings that tea, or Yvette. And it's very good. It's really excellent Taiwanese tea much of the time. But it's not the Taiwanese tea that makes it so delicious. It's that you're experiencing the tea having passed through deep samadhi. You experience the tea as part of yourself. You experience the date as part of yourself. The highest teaching of the Buddha isn't recalling past lives or flying through the air. It's becoming one with the world. See, becoming one with everything, all things. So the highest teaching is entering samadhi, bell rings, tea is served, and you eat the sesame cake. That's true liberation. That's true Buddha nature manifested in the realm of form. But nothing will happen if you don't sit, and nothing will happen if you don't sit for long periods. A monk asked Yunmen, What is talk transcending the Buddhas and the ancestors? Yunmen said a sesame cake. Verse, sesame cake, he says, in a talk transcending Buddhas and patriarchs. See, this is beyond words. This experience is wordless unification with the world. In the phrase, there is no flavor. How can it be investigated? So when you're in deep samadhi, the mind is empty. It has no qualities. It's clear like water. You'll notice sometimes when you're in deep sleep, your mind becomes clear like water. If patchwork monks one day knew, were one day full, then they will see Yunmen's face not ashamed. In other words, you know, if you're watching TV and you're having a cup of tea, you don't taste the tea. And you could have a whole plate full of sesame cakes and you could be shoving them into your mouth, right? Watching the football game, let's say. Now, I have never actually seen a football game. Isn't that interesting? So you're watching something on TV, and you're drinking tea, and you're shoving sesame cakes into your mouth, and you eat a whole plate of sesame cakes, and they had no flavor because you're not present with the sesame cakes. You're in samsara. But when you begin to cultivate samadhi, the art of samadhi, emptying yourself on the cushion, everything becomes your true nature. Everything comes alive. All the world is your home. See, everything becomes your sesame cake.